Fisher continued to stare straight into Sir Martin's eyes, slowly chipping away at the foundations of his confidence. She admired his refusal to flinch, but his hand was too close to his sword for her to let it pass.
You can move that hand away from your sword hilt right now, because if you don't, we'll take it away from you and skewer you with it, as an example to others.
You can't threaten us all!
Sir Martin didn't sound quite as sure as he had. There was something about Hawk and Fisher, something in their calm voices and cold eyes that told him they meant every word. They had to know they were facing impossible odds, but everything about them clearly said they didn't care.
We can do anything, because we don't care about anything but the truth.
And to hell with whoever gets hurt in the process. You're politicians and aristocrats. You're all bound to be guilty of something.
Your Majesty, I appeal to you.
No, you don't. I like them with more meat on their bones. And you always were too smarmy for my taste, Martin. You've got some nerve looking to me for support, when I know damn well you and your treacherous friends have been plotting to have me replaced as regent, so you'd have more direct influence over Stephen's upbringing.
Sir Martin turned reluctantly back to Hawk, his hand well away from his sword.
Captain Hawk, be reasonable.
Sorry, we don't do reasonable. Now be a good little politician and fade back into the woodwork.
You're very good when it comes to intimidating chinless wonders like Martin, but not all of us are so easily browbeaten.
Hawk looked around quickly. He knew that voice. It had been 12 years, but he knew that voice and always would. And sure enough, a familiar figure came striding out of the crowd to confront him as Sir Martin retreated. Still lithe and muscular despite approaching middle age, head held high and moving with a calm grace that bordered on arrogance, the man Rupert had known as Rob Hawk came to a halt before the throne. There was gray in his hair, and age and good living had softened the harsh features, but Hawk knew him immediately. Rupert and Rob Hawk passed through the dark wood together, fought demons side by side, guarded each other's back, each risking his life for the other without a second thought. Rob Hawk was one of the few surviving real heroes of the Demon War, knighted afterward by King Harold for his services to the land. A warrior who had impressed Prince Rupert so much, he took Rob Hawk's last name for himself when he went south. He was also, possibly, the only man here to have seen Rupert with his scars and eye patch, if only briefly. If anyone here would recognize Hawk as Rupert, it would be this man. Hawk did his best to stand at ease, unmoved, and met his old companion's gaze steadily.
And you are?
Sir Robert Hawk, Landsgrave. I speak for a form. And I don't intimidate easily.
I know. Well, I've heard some of the songs about your exploits in the Demon War.
Believe everything you've heard. And after the long night, there's not much left that scares me anymore.
They stood and looked at each other in silence for a long while. Two men who had once been closer than brothers, but had grown apart in such different ways. The years had not been entirely kind to Sir Robert. Up close, he looked older than his age, as though he had been much buffeted about by life. He looked more like the father of the man Rupert had once known. Hawk couldn't help wondering if he himself had changed that much as well.
We're here on the authority of Prince Rupert and Princess Julia, and we have the backing of your queen. Do you defy them?
Not necessarily. Not just now. I'll give you enough rope to hang yourselves. But tread carefully, captains. There's a lot going on here you don't know about. There are secrets within mysteries, and not everyone's truth is the same. Not everyone is always who or what they appear to be.
Hawk and Fisher looked at each other, unsure whether that was a hint of recognition or not. Certainly nothing in Sir Robert's face or gaze suggested that he recognized Rupert and Julia. Perversely, Hawk felt almost disappointed. How could Rob Hawk have forgotten him so completely after all they'd been through together? Sir Vivian stepped forward to fix Sir Robert with his icy gaze.
You seem to know so much about this tangled situation, Landsgrave. Perhaps you would be so good as to suggest how it should be investigated.
You know my feelings on the matter, High Commander. I've made no secret of them. The only way to get the truth is to question everyone, from the highest to the lowest, under a truth spell.
That would take months. And besides, it would be a deathly insult to all those of standing who had given their word they knew nothing of King Harold's death, sworn it on their name and their blood and their honor. Who would you trust to administer such a truth spell anyway? The Magus? I don't know of anyone in this court, or out of it, who trusts him entirely. The Shaman, with his well-known prejudices? Or perhaps some academy witch chosen at random? No. Given the circumstances of the murder, no magic user can be trusted. It's clear to me, and to anyone who studied the matter, that the king's murder must have involved some use of magic. There's no other way the assassin could have reached him. Past my guards and the magus's wards. No. The first step of getting anywhere has to be the rounding up and imprisoning of all the magic users currently infesting this castle, and put them all to the question under a truth spell.
Any magician powerful enough to get past the magus wards would have no trouble shrugging off a truth spell. And besides, magic has become too integral a part of our society. The castle and the land couldn't function without magic users. We can't afford to antagonize them. It makes much more sense to vigorously interrogate all your compromised guards, who continue to swear they saw and heard nothing of the king's murder, even though they were right outside the room when it happened. We could always replace them with the more independent members of our armed forces.
You might be willing to place your trust in foreign mercenaries, but then your commitment to the throne has always been dubious at best. My people remain. They are the only ones who know the castle and its people well enough to be able to investigate this matter thoroughly.
As always, we remain opposed. The old versus the new.
Honor versus practicality.
Why don't we get right down to it? With the king regrettably gone, this is the perfect opportunity to change the system. We can put aside the monarchy, which serves only itself, and replace it with a more democratic system that serves the people.
King Harold stood fast against any real changes while he was alive, and I support what remains of his family. Your words, however, sound more and more like a motive for murder. Did you tire of waiting for change and decide to start the process yourself with Harold's death?
Both Sir Robert and Sir Vivian had their hands on their sword hilts now, and imminent violence crackled in the air. Sir Vivian's guards moved quickly forward to support him, and just as quickly, stern-faced courtiers emerged from the crowd to back up Sir Robert. Everyone stopped and turned to look at the queen.
Harold never allowed anyone to go armed in his court, and it's temper tantrums like this that explain why. Sir Questor?
Chance stepped forward.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Do you still serve the throne and your queen?
Yes, Your Majesty.
Then do us the favor of killing the first damned fool to draw his sword.
Delighted, Your Majesty.
Chance had his father's huge double-headed axe in his hands, bearing the great weight as though it were nothing. And Hawk felt a sharp frisson of memory as he saw the dead champion's cold killer's smile on Chance's lips. The dog Chappie stood at Chance's side, fur bristling. Everyone very deliberately took their hands away from their swords, including Sir Robert and Sir Vivian. Chance nodded slowly.
That's better. See how much more fun sanity is? Everybody calm down right now, or they'll be clearing up what's left of you with a mop.
How typical of the monarchy, to settle debate with the threat of violence. Just another sign of how intellectually empty its position is. Take Hawk and Fisher, only here because Rupert and Julia declined to return. What are they but bullies with little power? The prince and the princess knew the days of monarchy are over. That's why they're not here.
Bullshit! They just have other responsibilities.
Yes, well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
In all the songs and stories I heard, Rupert was your friend, your comrade in arms. Together you fought the darkness to preserve the Forest Kingdom. Do you think he'd approve of what you're doing now? Of what you've become?
That was a long time ago.
Sir Robert met Hawk's gaze steadily.
Everything has changed since then. Rupert was a hero because of what he did, not because he was a prince. He fought for justice and the preservation of the forest people. If he was here now, I'd follow him into hell itself, just on his word. But he isn't here, and I don't know you, Captain Hawk.
Company's coming.
Everyone shut up and turned around. Through the open doors of the court came Duke Ulric of Hillsdown, last in the line of Starlight Dukes, striding into the forest court like he owned the place, or at the very least was thinking seriously of leasing it. 20 armed and armored guards accompanied him. The packed court shuffled backward to open up a wide aisle for the Duke and his guards to walk down on his way to the throne. Queen Felicity's guards snapped to attention and moved quickly in to stand on either side of her, glaring openly at the Duke and his guards. Ulric ignored them all as he made his slow way toward the throne. He was an old man now, in his late 70s, not much more than skin and bone. His face was deeply lined, dominated by a jutting chin and nose. His mouth was a grim, flat line, the lips pressed so tightly together they could hardly be seen. His eyes were sunken, but still sharp and bright. He'd lost his hair long ago, save for a few white wisps over each ear. Hawk's first impression was that the Duke looked uncommonly like a vulture. The Duke was dressed in dusty gray formal attire, and his stick-thin body was held together by a series of leather straps and metal braces, encompassing his torso like a cage and extending down both arms and legs. Straps and hinges creaked loudly as he walked. More sounds came from within him, and he grunted now and again with the simple effort of walking. But for all the obvious frailty of his worn-out body, there was no mistaking the fire, arrogance, and determination that kept him moving. The Duke was still a dangerous man, and everyone there in the court knew it.
Damn, he's gotten old since I last saw him. He used to be such a fighter, such a warrior. Now look at him. Time's eaten him away. Sure, he's still the Duke. He'll still be deadly as a coiled snake till the day they nail his coffin lid down. I'm not afraid of him anymore. I don't know this man. This old man. I wonder if he'll know me.
Duke Ulric crashed to a halt before the throne and glared at Queen Felicity, ignoring everyone else. He was breathing heavily and his hands trembled, but his gaze was perfectly steady. The Queen did her best to look imperiously down on him, but it was clear to everyone how much of an effort that was.
Well, daughter, you've been drinking again. I can smell it.
Father, to what do we owe the pleasure of your company? Found something else in your quarters to complain about?
Don't get smart with me, Felicity. I put you on the throne. I can remove you from it if I have to.
You are addressing the Queen of the Forest Land. The correct form of address is Your Majesty. Try not to forget again. I'd hate to have you dragged from this court in chains for disrespect. Really, I'd hate it.
Muzzle your dog, Felicity. Word has come to me that you are considering accepting these guard nobodies in place of Rupert and Julia. You can't do that. They're not fit to investigate your husband's murder. Send them away. Then send your faithful hound back to fetch Rupert and Julia and demand they come home. Be a queen, dammit!
You just want me out of the way!
The Duke still ignored Chance, his unwavering gaze fixed on his daughter, who was beginning to squirm under the pressure of his regard.
All right, you have a point. Rupert and Julia
aren't coming.
Hawk moved forward to stand between the Queen and the Duke. Fisher moved quickly to his side, glaring at her father.
Fisher and I are here, and we will investigate this murder and uncover the guilty. We're not going anywhere. We're needed here, if only because we're the only ones without an axe of our own to grind. So back off, Starlight Duke, or I'll clip your suspenders and braces.
The Duke looked at him in silence. It had clearly been a long time since anyone had dared to openly defy him. Fisher seized the advantage.
Why would you want to see your daughter Julia again anyway, Duke Ulric? Didn't you condemn her to death all those years ago?
The Duke shrugged.
She disobeyed me. She disappointed me. And since I had seven other daughters, I had to keep them in line somehow. Trust Julia not to do what was expected of her. Perhaps she's afraid to come back and face me again.
I doubt that. She faced the Darkwood, the Long Night, and the Demon Prince. An old man held together with knotted string and sealing wax isn't much of a threat after that.
I am the sovereign monarch of Hillsdown. You will not speak to me that way.
Sure we will. You're not the first ruler we've faced down, and you won't be the last. You have no authority over us. We're Hawk and Fisher, and we don't bend the knee to anyone.
Duke Ulric turned to his guards.
Kill them!
The Hillsdown guards drew their swords and surged forward, silent and focused. Hawk and Fisher drew their weapons and went to meet them. Everyone else watched with open mouths as swords clashed, blood flew on the air, and Hawk and Fisher wiped the floor with all 20 guards. Chance hopped around the perimeter of the action.
Don't kill any of them! Please, don't kill them!
The Hillsdown guards were trained, experienced men, but they were no match for Hawk and Fisher, who were shaped and trained under harsher conditions than anyone in Hillsdown had known in generations. Soon there was a lot of blood on the floor and more on the clothes of those courtiers who hadn't stood far enough back. Soon, wounded and unconscious guards lay everywhere. The last few threw down their swords and surrendered. Hawk and Fisher looked around them, quietly satisfied, flicked drops of blood from their blades, and sheathed their weapons, not even bothering to look in Ulric's direction. Sir Robert Hawk led the applause, and most of the courtiers joined in. Queen Felicity looked as if she would have very much liked to. Chance approached Hawk and Fisher.
Can't you two get on with anyone?
We didn't kill anyone.
And that's your idea of diplomacy, is it?
Well, mostly, yes. Think of it as a statement of principles. Or not. See if we care. Now, where were we, Ulrich?
Chance moved quickly to stand between them and the Duke.
That's enough. The Duke is a guest of this court, and as such is under my protection. Guards are one thing. I can't let you threaten the Duke.
Spoil sport.
And then everything stopped. The terrible sound reverberated on the air like slow thunder, and everyone in the court could feel it in their hearts and their souls. The sound affected them all, like nails scraping down their bones. The awful bell rang on and on, like the devil calling the damned to worship at his cloven hooves.
What is that? What is that sound? Where's it coming from?
It is the great bell of the inverted cathedral. It hasn't been heard in centuries.
Then why is it ringing now?
Something new has come into the castle. Something that changes everything.
The Magus didn't look at Hawk and Fisher.
Who's ringing the bloody thing?
Lightfoot Moonfleet clapped her tiny hands to her pointed ears.
I don't know. The Burning Man, perhaps?
The hell with who's ringing it! How do we make it stop?
The Magus had no answer. Everyone in the court had their hands over their ears now, but it didn't help. The tolling of the awful bell of the inverted cathedral could have been heard by a deaf man, and a mute man would have cried out in horror at the sound of it. People were crying now. Some were shaking or vomiting. Everywhere in the court, the light dimmed and the shadows grew darker. There was a sense of terrible presences moving inside the shadows. Everyone who had a weapon had drawn it. Panic grew in the packed hall, held back only by lack of a common cause to attack or run from. And then the people on the edges of the court, those nearest the shadows, began to sway and stumble like drunken men. The color went out of their faces, their eyes became vague, and there was something almost insubstantial about them, as though their very life was being sucked out of them. Their faces twisted with a terrible disgust, as though they were being drained by giant leeches. Some fell into the shadows, which swallowed them and consumed them like inky waters. The courtiers nearest those lost to the shadows fought each other in their desperate need to get away from the hungry darkness. The shadows grew larger, darker, deeper. The whole crowd was dangerously close to stampeding now. A few people cut at the shadows with their swords, but the steel slipped harmlessly through the darkness. Hawk and Fisher stood back to back, weapons at the ready, looking for an enemy they could fight. The queen stood up before her throne.
Do something, damn it! Somebody do something!
The only spells I know strong enough to throw back an evil like this would probably kill the court. If the situation deteriorates further, I may have to do that. But for the moment, I think we'd be better off organizing a controlled evacuation of the court.
If they run, half of them will be crushed and trampled to death anyway. Do something!
Alas, your majesty, I cannot...
You're standing there making excuses and people are dying!
The witch Tiffany burst out of the crowd.
Typical sorcerer, get out of my way!
She floated up into the air, the slippers falling from her rising feet, her long red hair floating around her untroubled face like a great crimson cloud. She rose above the noise and turmoil of the panicking crowd, her hands crossed on her breast like some old romantic's vision of an angel. Her eyes were closed, her brow furrowed in concentration. The iron bell missed a beat.
Fiat Lux! Let there be light!
A bright light, shining and brilliant beyond any color, swept through the court like refreshing rain on a hot afternoon. It bathed everyone in its blazing glory, sleeting light through their bodies in a rush of calm and forgiveness. It filled the court, bright as mercy, vivid as justice, driving out the dark and the shadows, which could not stand against it. Those people who had been swallowed up by the dark returned, blinking dazedly, unharmed. And then the dark and the light were both gone, and the tolling of the awful bell stopped. The court was just a great hall again, and the shadows were just shadows. People murmured to each other, holding hands and hugging one another, and only Chance saw Tiffany fall out of the air like a stone. He fought his way through the crowd to reach her, shoving aside personages far greater than he without a backward glance. He knelt beside the fallen witch, lying crumpled on the floor like a discarded handkerchief. He checked her breathing and her pulse. He found them both normal. He rubbed her hands.
Tiffany.
Tiffany slowly opened her eyes, green as the most luscious grassy meadows of the forest land, and twice as warm. They smiled at each other, and for a long moment, that was all they needed.
I wasn't sure that would work. Never tried it before. Found the spell in an old Forbidden Grim war I wasn't supposed to know about. Technically, only a sorceress should have been able to power a spell like that, but somehow I knew that I could do it, because it was needed. Am I making sense?
As much as usual. Do you think you could stand up if you leaned on me?
I think so, Alan. Promise me you won't go away.
I'll always be there when you need me, Tiff.
They rose slowly to their feet, chance strong enough for both of them. They smiled into each other's eyes, and neither of them noticed rose petals raining down around them.
Now that was interesting.
Is that all you have to say? You're supposed to be the official sorcerer to this court. Why didn't you do that?
Because such a spell would almost certainly have destroyed me. So much power unleashed should have burned Tiffany to ashes from the inside out.
Then why didn't it?
Damned if I know. But it is interesting.
Never mind that now. What was that bell all about? And those shadows, what does it mean?
I think it means that something in the inverted cathedral is waking up. But I'm unable at this time to ascertain who or what that might be.
A lot of good you are.
The queen sank back onto her throne.
You couldn't save my herald, and you couldn't save my court. A witch from the academy had to do it. I knew there was a reason why I let them hang around. Somebody bring that witch to me.
Chance brought Tiffany forward, and the witch curtsied low before the throne.
I am Tiffany, your majesty, at your service.
Look at you.
The queen smiled despite herself.
I never looked that good even when I was your age, and that's more years ago than I care to remember. You did well, Tiffany. We hereby appoint you official witch to this court. You will join with the quester in defending this court from all its enemies without and within. Work with the mages, or not, as you please.
I am honored, your majesty.
Tiffany curtsied again.
Yes, you are. You can start work by cleaning up all those rose petals.
She looked out over the court.
Everyone else, this session is now at an end. I think we've all had as much excitement as we can stand for one day. And I need to get my feet up for an hour or so, or I'm going to have one of my headaches. Duke Ulrich, you have our permission to retire to your quarters. We'll send you back your guards once the surgeons have put them back together. Sir Vivian and Sir Robert, save it for another day. Hawk and Fisher, get me some answers. Court is now dismissed.
She levered herself up out of her throne with sudden snapping sounds from her joints and stalked off while everyone else was still in mid-bow and curtsy. Her guards hurried after her. Hawk turned to Sir Vivian.
We're going to need quarters here. Prince Rupert said we could have his old quarters in the Northwest Tower.
You can't have those. They're for royalty.
Well, is anyone using them right now?
Well, no. We were maintaining them for Prince Rupert and Princess Julia when they returned. But it wouldn't be proper.
We don't do proper. We can, however, get really cranky if we don't get our way.
Hawk and Fisher looked meaningfully at the wounded and unconscious Hillsdown guards and then looked back at Sir Vivian. One of the guards close at hand chose this moment to stir. Fisher kicked him in the head and he fell gratefully back into unconsciousness. Everyone watching winced, including Hawk and Sir Vivian.
Oh, hell, have the bloody rooms!
Sometime later, Hawk and Fisher were preparing for bed in what used to be Prince Rupert's old quarters. He was pleased to see they'd kept them just as he had left them. There wasn't much there, just the same old bed and bare minimum of furniture. Someone had thoughtfully used a bed warmer to take the chill off the sheets, and the adjoining bathroom was spotless. There were no frills or fancies or anything other than the most basic of comforts. Rupert had never had time for such things back then. He sat on the edge of the bed, trying to decide whether the room still felt like home. Fisher came in from the bathroom, toweling her damp hair.
The dye's still sticking, thank God. Oh, I hope we'll be through here before my roots start to show.
Fisher looked around the room, unimpressed.
Was it always as Spartan as this?
Pretty much, yes. Now you know why I never invited you back here. This is where Rupert hid from the world, from the castle, and all the people in it who wanted to hurt or use him. Can't really think of any good memories. Mostly, I remember being afraid of the dark after I passed through the Darkwood. The long night put its mark on me then. I slept here, with the door locked and the nightlight on. Once I even pushed the wardrobe across to barricade the door. You know, I'm not so sure I want to sleep here after all.
You'll be fine. That was all a long time ago. The dark's no threat to us now.
Are you sure? You saw what happened in the court when that bell tolled. The shadows were a lot like the darkness of the long night. And the witch summoning the light was a hell of a lot like my calling down the rainbow.
Don't see everything in terms of our past, love.
Fisher sat on the bed beside him.
We're together now. And together, we can handle anything the world can throw at us.
Hawk took her hand in his.
As long as we're together. Don't ever let them separate us, Isabel.
Never. Never again.
Through the eternal darkness, through the dead land where the sun has never shone, Jericho Lament came walking. Jericho Lament, the walking man, the wrath of God in the world of mankind. He strode briskly between the rotting trees of the Darkwood, eyes staring calmly straight ahead of him. In one hand he bore aloft a blazing torch whose flame never faltered, and in his other he carried a long wooden staff, almost as tall as he was, weighted with steel at one end and silver at the other. Lament wore a dark, ankle-length coat over worn gray leathers, and the heels of his boots were worn down with all the countless miles he'd walked in the service of his god. His face was lean and deeply lined, his eyes cold and blue as the sky over a field of endless ice. His slight smile was even colder than his eyes. His nose had been broken more than once, and a lion's mane of long gray hair fell from under a battered, broad-brimmed hat. He leaned forward as he walked, as though just about to break some invisible tape at the end of a race that was always somewhere just ahead of him. In the darkness all around the walking man, demons moved silently behind the dead trees, following Jericho Lament at a safe distance. For all their numbers, none of them dared enter the small pool of steady light he walked in. Somehow they knew who and what he was, and they were afraid.
Best to fear the Lord.
Jericho Lament could have bypassed the Darkwood if he'd chosen, but he wanted to test himself and his faith against that spiritual darkness. So he pulled his courage and his self-control about him like a protective cloak and walked unhesitatingly out of the light and into the dark. The horrid oppression of the endless night had hit him hard, like a physical blow, but his step never faltered and his pace never slowed. In that place where the sun had never shone and never would, the unearthly cold sank deep into his bones, leeching away at his life's warmth. And the long night lay heavily upon him, like those terrible empty hours of the early morning, when a man cannot sleep for thoughts of his own mortality. But the endless dark and the lonely cold could not turn aside, or even slow, Jericho Lament, the walking man. It was no match for the holy fire that burned forever within him, that seared him more harshly than the dark ever could. It is not an easy or a pleasant thing to be a living avatar of the good and the just. Lament rode no horse, nor any other form of transport, and never had. He was the walking man, and his contract with the Lord forbade such weaknesses. He was not the first to bear that title, to bind himself to God, to damn himself to heaven's work. Once, years ago, he had been just another monk, in a small, quiet monastery miles from anywhere that mattered, famed locally for a wine that did not travel well. He worked the gardens and the vineyards, made his prayers and did charitable work, meditated quietly in the peace of his humble cell, and was almost content. Then the long night fell across the forest land, and the demons came hopping and scuttling outside the monastery. Neither the monk's faith nor the monastery's high stone walls were enough to stop the demons. They climbed the walls and smashed down the locked doors. Blood ran freely across the wooden floors. Some monks died where they stood rather than raise a hand in violence, even against demons. They fell with blessings on their bloody lips, and the demons didn't care. Other monks, like the man who had once been Jericho Lament, took up improvised weapons against the invading demons and fought them back. Lament crushed demon skulls with a heavy silver crucifix and praised his god with every blow. And when the long night passed and the sun returned, all the demons were dead, and only those monks who had fought for their lives survived. Jericho Lament had stood there, overlooking the bodies of the fallen, with blood dripping thickly from his crucifix. He took a lesson from that. The monastery housed an excellent library from a time when the monastery had been a more central and important place. Centuries old, mostly forgotten now by the outside world, the library had books on its dusty shelves that no man had consulted for long and long. Old books, perhaps the only remaining copies in the forest land. Lament worked his way through the handwritten pages with almost feverish speed, searching for something he could feel but not put a name to. Finally, in a book whose silver locks he had to shatter with an iron axe from the gardens, he found what he needed. The Legend of the Walking Man. In every generation, the book said, a man can swear his life to God and become more than a man. The pages outlined a contract between man and God that once entered into could not be broken by either party. If that man would swear to serve the light and the good for all his life, forswearing all other paths, such as love or family or personal needs, then he could become the walking man, stronger, faster, and more terrible than any other man. He would become invulnerable as long as his faith remained strong. God's warrior, more than mortal. The wrath of God in the world of men, everything Jericho Lament was not when the demons burst through the monastery doors and came swarming over the holy walls to slaughter good men.
My life to your purpose, Lord.
Lament entered into the compact willingly, saying the words and making the terrible promises. A holy fire came down, burning him within and without, searing away all human limits and hesitations. From now on, he would walk in straight lines and go where he must and do what he had to, turning aside for nothing and for no one. He could accept no human help or compromise, and he only possessed what he could carry with him. Jericho Lament left the monastery and never once looked back. His brothers, men who had fought beside him against the demons, were now afraid of him. And so Jericho Lament went back and forth in the forest land and hills down and Red Heart, aiding the needy and punishing the wicked, bringing to bear the terrible anger of the walking man on those who would dare trespass against the light. Because Lament followed God's law rather than man's, and never hesitated to strike down an evil man, no matter how powerful he might be, there were always warrants out for his arrest. In many places, there was an impressive price on his head, and he was pursued by a more tenacious than usual pack of bounty hunters when he came to the border of the Darkwood. The bounty hunters didn't worry him. Their horses had to rest sometime, while he never did. Jericho Lament hadn't rested or slept or dreamed in 11 years, and it pleased him to walk where no other man would dare to follow for fear of his soul.
Dare not to stand in the way of the Lord.
There was nearly always someone on his trail. The walking man did what he had to, as the voice within bade him, and his uncompromising justice nearly always led to grief for some undeserving soul. Even the most evil of men could have friends or family who valued them and were determined to avenge him. Lament preferred to leave them behind rather than kill them. Such people were misguided, not evil, and he had no business with them. He was not without compassion, though he could not allow himself pity. Lament's most recent case had been a sad one, though necessary. The girl had been possessed. The exorcism had failed, so all that was left was to kill her and set her soul free. Her family hadn't seen it that way. The whole town turned out to pursue him. He didn't blame them. Eventually they grew tired and gave up, but the bounty hunters they hired didn't. Now they were gone too, left behind, and Lament concentrated on his next mission as he strode through the dark wood. The voice had been most specific and unusually urgent. Jericho Lament had given his life to God over love or longing or rest. But there were times, for all his faith, when he wasn't always sure whom he'd given it to.
Lord, give me your strength. Show me your purpose.
The walking man studied God's word wherever he went, reading his way through testaments and gospels and epistles in libraries small and large. The older the books, the more confusing things became. The church had known many shapes and directions over the centuries, some of them impossibly conflicted. The word of God rarely changed much, but the interpretations could vary widely, sometimes to the point of civil wars. There were always established churches, and there were always heretics. Sometimes the heretics became the establishment, only to face new heretics in turn. Lament learned to see the varying branches of the faith as distractions from his holy purpose, and regarded them with only intellectual interest. His contract was with God, not his priests. The light may cast many reflections, but it is still the light that matters. He had no patience for the pagan faiths that mushroomed through the countryside after the long night, and he destroyed pagan sites and ancient stones wherever he encountered them. They were a distraction from the true God. Lament took no pleasure in the destruction, especially when it was clear the pagan sites and stones gave comfort to people. But he knew his duty.
Comfort lies with the Lord.
Right now, his duty led him to Forest Castle. The demons of the Darkwood kept pace with him, staying just beyond the edges of his pool of light, watching him hungrily, but still scared or sensible enough to maintain their distance. They were of the dark and knew the light when they saw it. Lament was almost disappointed. He would have liked to kill some demons, partly for the exercise, partly so they would never again be a menace to travelers. But mostly because someone buried deep within him still remembered the terrible fear he'd felt as demons tore his fellow monks apart all those years ago. Lament knew now that the demons had been people once, but that didn't stay his hand. As far as he was concerned, demons were just the risen dead, no more worthy of sparing than a vampire or a ghoul. They were dead and should be put to rest for their soul's sake. But his mission had precedence, and so he strode briskly along between the dead trees, following the narrow trail the legendary Prince Rupert hacked out so many years before. Lament would have liked to kill some demons, for his own comfort and peace of mind. And so he didn't, because he was the walking man and had to be beyond such personal needs.
I am the Lord's hand of justice.
The walking man, the wrath of God in the world of men, was heading inexorably toward Forest Castle and the inverted cathedral and one final terrible act of faith. The witch Tiffany sat alone in her quarters at Forest Castle, braiding her flame-red hair in front of a tall mirror. It was a pleasant, airy room, small enough to be cozy, while still large enough to acknowledge her status in the castle. Such things had to be nicely calculated. Flowers stood in earthen pots everywhere. Tiffany liked flowers, but not in vases. Cut flowers in glass vases were just dying slowly, and Tiffany couldn't bear to hear them screaming. The flowers' combined perfume gave the air in the room a refreshing, lively ambience. The bed was very comfortable, piled high with soft sheets over a deep, supportive mattress, but even so, Tiffany had swung cheerfully out of it at first light. She couldn't understand lazy slug-a-beds who would rather sleep on than go bustling forth to see what wonders the day would reveal. It helped that she was young and full of more energy than she knew what to do with. The servants had left her strictly vegetarian breakfast outside the door again, rather than bring it in. They were somewhat in awe of Academy witches, and of Tiffany in particular. This rather disappointed her. She'd been trying really hard to fit in, but she supposed it came with the job. She realized her reflection in the mirror was frowning, so she quickly smiled to smooth the lines away. Frowns led to wrinkles, and besides, bad within led to bad without. Face the world with a smile, and it will smile right back at you. She brushed hard at her long hair, removing the last few tangles of sleep, and tried to think only happy thoughts. Tiffany tried very hard to think the best of absolutely everybody as a matter of principle, particularly those people she didn't like. Everyone has some good in them, if you dig deep enough. She pursed her perfect mouth at the tartness of that last thought. She tried to have positive thoughts about everyone, but some people made it harder than most. Like Captains Hawk and Fisher, for example, who seemed to her nothing more than rude, arrogant, offensive bullies.
Alan,
What do you know?
She didn't know what Alan Chance saw in them. But just possibly, Hawk and Fisher were what the castle needed right now. Certainly her own quiet investigations into King Harold's death got her absolutely nowhere. Any number of people had been happy to tell her all sorts of things they shouldn't have once she turned her wide-eyed, empty-headed routine on them, but she hadn't learned anything of use. Everyone she talked to had plenty of theories and plenty of unsubstantiated gossip, but no one knew anything for sure. And those few who might, the real movers and shakers of Forest Castle, had more sense than to speak openly in front of an academy witch, no matter how innocent and charming she seemed. The Queen, in particular, had been most unhelpful. She'd agreed to see Tiffany more than once, but seemed more interested in exchanging the very latest gossip than in talking about things that really mattered. She was also totally and very firmly uninterested in all the things Tiffany's magic could do, even when they might have been useful to her. Queen Felicity might not have much use for her official advisors, but it seemed even she listened to them on the subject of how dangerous an academy witch could be.
I shouldn't be surprised.
Of course, they were quite right, but still. Tiffany admired the Queen Regent and would have liked to be able to help her. She hadn't been anywhere near Duke Ulric. His small army of bodyguards went pale and drew their weapons if she ever looked like she was going anywhere near his quarters, and formed a solid block around him any time the two of them were at court together. The gesture was flattering, but not particularly helpful. The Duke might be obnoxious, arrogant, and a potential threat to the whole forest land, but she still needed to talk to him. There were things she needed to know about his plans and ambitions and what he was doing here at Forest Castle, and why every time she looked at him, she saw blood dripping endlessly from his twisted hands. A witch's sight wasn't always completely reliable, for any number of reasons, including the difficulties of interpretation, but some sights were indisputable. Tiffany needed to know whether she was seeing the Duke's past or his future. She couldn't afford to do anything drastic to him until she determined the source of the old man's guilt. On top of that, the Walking Man was coming to Forest Castle. As if she and everyone else didn't have enough problems. For someone supposed to be an avatar of the good and the holy, that man could cause more upsets, general mayhem, and high body counts than a major war and an outbreak of plague combined. She remembered suddenly that Alan Chance was on his way to see her and brightened up immediately.
Alan.
She liked Alan. He was kind and thoughtful and always treated her like a lady. More importantly, he wasn't frightened of her. And she just loved the way he went all red-faced and flustered when she took a deep breath and stuck out her bosom. Men were so easy to manipulate sometimes. It helped that Chance was very handsome and even charming in an awkward way. If only he wasn't his father's son. Sometimes when Tiffany looked at Chance's shadow, she saw the shadow of a much larger and far more dangerous man. She tired suddenly of playing with her hair. She tied the braid off with quick, careless knots, jumped to her feet, and moved over to look out of the room's only window. She usually found the view from this high up on the South Tower diverting, even comforting. But today, something was undermining its ability to ease her mood. The forest looked the same, but Tiffany knew there was a darkness coming, even without using her sight. The forest just couldn't help but look different. Everyone in the academy knew something bad was coming, but not even the most advanced and experienced witches had been able to put a name to it. The sisters were all pretty sure it had something to do with the return of the inverted cathedral, but those witches who tried their sight on the inverted cathedral came to awful ends. The lucky died quickly. The few survivors lay in straitjackets in isolated cells, bleeding constantly from terrible stigmata, screaming, laughing, speaking in tongues no one understood. The Mother Witch had made Tiffany visit those poor unfortunates before she let her go to Forest Castle, so she wouldn't be tempted to try the sight herself. Tiffany cried for over an hour afterward, then never cried again. She could be strong when she had to. She could feel the inverted cathedral's presence wherever she was in the castle. A harsh, hateful presence, like the endless pain of a nagging tooth. And going anywhere near the inverted cathedral felt like being in the presence of something awful about to give birth to something even worse. Tiffany was potentially the most powerful witch the Academy of the Sisters of the Moon ever produced. She knew this because her superiors had been telling her ever since her first period when her magic first began to manifest. The signs and portents surrounding her birth had apparently been something to see. That's why she was here, in the castle. Because the Academy was convinced she was supposed to be here. But the more she thought about it, the more Tiffany worried she wouldn't be strong enough to face whatever it was, whenever it finally happened. For all her power, Tiffany never thought of herself as anyone special. Part of her wanted to run screaming from the castle right now and flee back to the safety of the Academy, where she felt protected and secure, where the day-to-day world had been comfortably predictable, decided by those clearly superior to her. She cried hot tears when they told her she had to leave the Academy early because her presence was needed at the Forest Castle, and because there was nothing more they could teach her. The world outside the Academy was so confusing, and she missed her friends. Tiffany shook her head quickly. These were a child's thoughts. She was a grown woman now, with a woman's responsibilities, and she was a witch. She pushed open the window and put her face out into the morning sunshine. As she raised her face to the morning, birds came from everywhere to sing for her. They came flying in from all directions, in ones and twos and small clouds, dropping out of the morning sky to circle and wheel before and above and around her. Dozens and dozens of them, of all sizes and species and colors. The song took on a power of its own, spreading farther than any volume could ever have carried it, till everyone in the castle stopped to hear, and everyone who heard it felt their hearts lift for a moment, and the cares of the day seemed a little lighter for everybody. Then something frightened the birds. In a moment, they all stopped singing and flew away. Something new had come into the forest. Tiffany could feel it. She turned her sight on the view before her, and the forest changed. It was dark and corrupt, and overhead the returned blue moon glowed with the only color eyes can see at night. Its wild malevolence crackled on the darkness, moving over all the forest, its irresistible influence changing everything. Wild magic ran loose in the world, and nothing could stand against it, not law, nor custom, nor reason. Trees and foliage had been replaced by terrible, insane plant growths whose shapes made no sense, and between them moved creatures like living cancers, swollen and purulent. There were dark shapes, as big as houses, lurching through the transformed forest toward the castle to tear it down and grind its stones underfoot. And demons, demons everywhere. Then, in the middle of this sight of things to be, Tiffany saw herself. She saw her body impaled upon a twisting tree branch, its end bursting out of her wide-stretched mouth, its bark slick with her blood. And she was still alive, her eyes open and endlessly suffering. The door opened behind her, and she spun around. The horror that held her burst out of her in a scream she couldn't hold back. And then she saw Chance, and the last of the sight fell away. She ran forward into his arms and clung to him, shuddering and shaking, holding tears back with an effort. Chance held her close, bewildered, and did his best to make soothing, comforting noises. Slowly, she calmed down, bringing herself back under control through sheer willpower. She hung on to Chance a little longer than was really necessary. She felt safe in his arms, safe for the first time since she'd come to Forest Castle. But still, in the end, she made herself push him gently away, and he let go of her immediately.
What is it, Tiff? What's the matter? Did you see something?
Yes. A vision of the future. Or what might be the future.
A vision so bad it made you scream. What did you see?
Tiffany shook her head firmly.
It wasn't certain. The future is shifting all the time. It was more like a warning, a prediction of what might happen if we don't do something to prevent it.
Like what?
I don't know.
Don't worry. I'd never let anything happen to you, Tiff. Never.
Tiffany smiled at him and wished she could believe him.
Food's pretty great. Hell, it's good just to have somebody else make it and bring it to our room.
Hawk and Fisher ate breakfast together in Rupert's old quarters. Fisher started the day as she always did, with 20 minutes hard exercise followed by a full and hearty meal, bacon, eggs, sausages, and a pint of good strong southern coffee. It was even fried bread to go with the fried eggs. Perfect. Fisher plowed through it all with a good appetite. She believed in attacking the day from the very beginning, bright-eyed and alert for whatever the morning might bring, preferably something she could hit. She was already fully dressed, her sword belt close at hand. Hawk, on the other hand, was still in his dressing gown. He sat slumped in his chair opposite her, trying to work up the energy for a good scratch. He hadn't shaved, and his hair stuck out in all directions. Hawk was not a morning person. He watched bleakly as Fisher wolfed down her food, his face expressing barely concealed horror. Hawk broke fast with a bowlful of bran cereal and a small glass of fruit juice, that being all his system could tolerate first thing in the morning. He tended not to really wake up until he'd been out of bed for at least a good hour, which was why they'd always done their best to avoid the morning shift in Haven. That early in the morning, you could rob a bank right in front of Hawk, hit him over the head with a club, and set fire to his trousers, and he wouldn't notice. In Haven, Fisher usually just shoved Hawk under the shower, turned the water on hard, and then joined him. That usually did the trick. However, the Forest Castle's plumbing apparently didn't extend to showers yet, which was possibly why Hawk was still in a decidedly grumpy mood when he and Fisher set out sometime later to start the day's round of interviews. Hawk was dressed, shaved, and awake, and looked like he hated every part of it. People tended to back away and give him and Fisher plenty of room as they strode down the branching stone corridors, following the guide the seneschal provided. Hawk lived all his early life in the castle and still remembered most of the main routes. Even so, he still needed a guide to lead him through the ever-changing locations of rooms, stairways, and corridors, some of which doubled back on you when you weren't looking.
Where the hell are we?
The Forest Castle's internal geography had always been eccentric, if not downright willful, and things had only gotten worse since the return of the missing South Wing and the reappearance of the inverted cathedral. On bad days, you were lucky if you woke up in the same room you went to sleep in. Or at least, that was the excuse people used. In the old days, the Seneschal, or more usually one of his people, would have led the way, following their magical instincts and well-trained internal maps. But apparently these days, the Seneschal rarely left his rooms. Instead, he relied upon a series of magical guides, directed by his will or his people's. Hawk and Fisher's guide was a bright glowing light that bobbed cheerfully on the air before them, like a candle flame without the candle. You told it where you wanted to go, and it took you there. Simple. Fisher was having none of it. She took the non-appearance of the Seneschal as a personal slight.
Why didn't the Seneschal come get us himself? Hey, guide! Tell the Seneschal to get his ass down here.
You're not that important. In fact, at this hour of the morning, no one is, except the Queen, and possibly the Duke. I don't do personal appearances anymore. I'm very busy. Don't bother me again, or I'll have the guide take you on an extended tour of the castle's sewer systems.
And that was that.
Huh. He hasn't changed much. In fact, he's just like I remember him.
He's about the only thing that is. This isn't the castle I remembered.
Is that good or bad?
I'm still deciding.
God, you're moody first thing in the morning.
Can we please change the subject? Where are we going first?
We went through this all last night, Hawk, when you weren't complaining about the lumpy mattress. We're starting with a visit to Harold's tomb, remember?
Appropriate. I feel like death warmed over and allowed to congeal.
They followed the bobbing light through the castle corridors, heading down into the depths of the castle, down to the great hall and crypt of the Forest Kings. 14 generations of the Forest line lay at rest there. Hawk hadn't been there since he was a child, at the funeral of his mother, Queen Eleanor. He'd found the sheer size of the place awesome rather than frightening, but even so, it hadn't looked to him like anywhere he wanted to spend his final rest. He said so, and his father, the king, hit him, and then hugged him tightly. King John took the death of his wife hard, and only held himself together through the service by his sense of duty. Hawk understood there was a tomb for his father in the crypt now, even though there'd been no body to inter. Custom had to be followed. Hawk hadn't been there for that funeral. He felt it more important to get himself and Julia out of the castle and some distance down the road before Harold got around to having him killed. Harold never took competition lightly. Now, Harold was dead too, laid out in the family crypt. It made Hawk feel old. He noticed everyone now giving him and Fisher lots of room, far more than could be accounted for by his general grumpiness. He could see fear in people's eyes, and the sudden averting of their gaze. From the highest courtier to the lowest servant, no one wanted to be anywhere near Hawk and Fisher. They hushed their voices and turned their heads aside and hurried off in different directions, muttering animatedly to each other the moment they thought they were at a safe distance.
I was wondering when you'd notice that.
They're scared of us. Why are they scared of us? All right, we put on an impressive performance last night, but only the guilty have anything to fear from us. We're here to protect the innocent. They shouldn't fear us.
Everyone's guilty of something.
Hawk thought about that for a while.
Even us?
The crypt of the Forest Kings was located deep down in the bedrock upon which Forest Castle was built. Entering its dusty embrace was like walking back into the past, rediscovering the legacy and blood right from which Prince Rupert sprung. The massive hall stretched away before the man now known as Hawk, its immense length lit by sorcerous blue flames on the wall that would never gutter or grow dim for as long as the forest line endured. Standing just inside the only door, the first thing Hawk noticed was the silence. It was like being at the bottom of the sea. There was no sound here, except what the living brought with them. Looking down the long reach of the hall was almost dizzying, like looking down the side of some plunging cliff face. The sheer scale of the crypt might originally have been planned to be impressive, but now, 14 generations later, it seemed simply practical. Lying quietly in their cold stone beds, in neat and ordered rows, the dead kings and their families stretched away into the distance, protected against time and decay, but not the forgetfulness of fickle descendants. When Prince Rupert had been brought down here as a small child to see his mother put to rest, he'd thought for a long time afterward that this was the actual afterlife, where you went when you died. A place of cold blue light and endless quiet. He thought that when everyone was gone, the dead rose up from their marble coffins and communed silently together in the endless hall. He suffered through nightmares for years. Now he found the crypt oddly comforting, a place of peace where no one made demands on you anymore. He was here again after decades away, and it seemed not a bad place to sleep for all eternity, surrounded by your family.
Damn, this place is huge. We've nothing like it in Hillsdown, but then we haven't been around that long. I bet you could spend hours down here, just checking off the names. How many of your family are down here, Hawk?
I don't think anyone knows anymore. Once, this would have been part of the Seneschal's rounds. He or his people would have kept detailed records on who everyone was and where, and what they did of note. And someone would have been responsible for placing fresh flowers and clearing away the old. But I suppose the place just got too crowded. Too many tombs, too much work. Until one of my ancestors decided that such time could be better spent at the service of the living. No one comes down here anymore except at funerals. And no one stays except those who have to.
The hall seems to go on forever. I can't even see the end from here. How are we going to find Harold's tomb?
The Seneschal's guide should take us right to it. As a recent arrival, he shouldn't be too far from the door.
They followed the bobbing light down the wide aisle in the center of the hall, passing by countless empty marble slabs, prepared for those forest dead yet to come. It was unbearably quiet. The only sound was that of their boots on the stone floor. It seemed a very small sound in such a large place. The sorcerous light all around them never wavered, reflecting palely from the surprisingly low ceiling overhead. Fisher stuck close to Hawk's side. The sheer size of the hall intimidated her, made her feel small, insignificant. She could almost feel the pressure of centuries of past history pressing down on her. Hillsdown was a relatively recent country, with only 4 generations between the current Starlight Duke and Hillsdown's founder. Walking through the forest crypt was like walking back into a past she could barely visualize. Fisher kept her back straight and held her head high. Coming here had been mostly her idea. She needed to see Harold's tomb, if only because part of her would never really believe he was dead and gone until she'd seen his final resting place. The first tomb they stopped beside was that of Rupert and Harold's father, King John IV. The solid stone coffin was 7 feet long and covered in traditional runes and decorative curlicues, topped by a life-sized marble statue of King John, lying supine in full armor, his hands crossed on his chest, holding the hilt of a long sword that rested upon the length of his body. The carved, cold marble face was idealized, but still recognizable. Hawk hadn't seen his father's face in 12 years, and something very like loss tugged at his heart. Despite lives lived pretty much constantly at odds, father and son made a kind of reconciliation at the end, fighting side by side against the overwhelming odds of the Demon War. The king's marble face had a peace it rarely knew in life, and was covered by a thin layer of undisturbed dust. No one had touched this tomb since it had been put in place.
Fancy carving, and a far better likeness than those official portraits of us up above.
A fine tomb. Of course, there's no one in it. They never did find my father's body. Still, it's the thought that counts.
They moved on. Hawk didn't look back. The crypt wasn't really cold, but there was a spiritual chill in the great hall that penetrated right through to the bone.
God, don't let me end up in a place like this. So far from light and warmth and living things. Just lay me down under the good green grass, with maybe a small stone for my name, and a nice view. Then let me sleep till Judgment Day. And if God is kind, I won't dream.
All too soon, they came to the tomb of King Harold I. The coffin was fully 8 feet long, with many detailed elaborations carved into its sides, depicting scenes of Harold fighting the demons in the Long Night. The statue lying supine on top of the coffin was exactly like King John's, except for having Harold's face and being much larger. There was a thin layer of dust covering this statue, too, and at the foot of the coffin, a single wreath held dead and withered flowers. It was clear to both Hawk and Fisher that no one had come to visit Harold since his funeral. Somehow, neither of them was surprised. Harold might or might not have been a good king, but he had never been the sort to inspire devotion after his death.
Why is Harold's coffin and statue bigger than John's?
Because he designed it himself. He always said he would. He cared about such things.
Presumably, that's why the statue's face is a bit more accurate. Probably had it carved while he was still alive.
Probably.
Hawk looked at the oversized coffin and found it hard to feel anything. He'd said all he had to say to Harold before he left the castle and the forest 12 long years ago. All their old jealousies and conflicts eroded away through distance and time, and now seemed like events that happened to other people. Standing there beside his brother's tomb, Hawk felt no real sorrow, or even regret. He was there out of duty, because Harold was family. And because, truth be told, Harold would have been there for him if matters had gone otherwise. Blood called to blood, family to family, no matter how separated they might become by time or space or emotion.
Damn you, Harold. I left the forest land in your hands so I could leave and turn my back on family duty. Couldn't you do anything right?
Nobody's been down here since the internment.
Fisher wrinkled her nose at the dust on Harold's carved face.
Not even the queen. Do you suppose that's significant?
Probably not. According to an old book my tutors once made me read, things were very different in the early days of the forest line. Then it was customary for the royal family to come down here at regular intervals to remember their ancestors, who they were and what they did. In those times, they held picnics between the tombs, retelling old stories of valor and courage. It was important to know the line from which you'd sprung, the history you came from, and to set an example of what would be expected of you once you came of age. But as the numbers of the dead increased, the practice declined and finally disappeared. Now the old deeds are only remembered in romanticized and probably inaccurate songs and plays that come and go according to the fashion of the day. And no one comes down here because they don't like to be reminded of the certainty of their own death. This is a place to be visited only briefly when necessary, and then forgotten as quickly as possible.
The Demon War might have had something to do with that. We all saw too much death under the blue moon. We all lost friends and loved ones. Can you blame people for wanting to concentrate on life rather than death after an experience like that?
I don't blame anyone.
Hawk looked slowly around him.
I never thought to see this place again. I fully expected to die in some filthy back alley in Haven. When I got too old or too slow and someone's sword proved to be just a little bit faster than my axe.
I never really thought about it at all. I expected to die in the Long Night. Every day since then has been a gift. A second life I had no right to expect.
We did die in Haven, sort of. And there was a place we went to.
I barely remember it. That sorcerer put a spell on us. You know, you can't trust anything to do with magic.
Damn it!
Hawk's sudden outburst surprised them both.
Harold deserved better than this. He was a real hero in the Demon War. For all his faults, and he had many, when the time came, he went out to fight the demons in the Long Night, to protect and preserve the forest land. It never even occurred to him not to. He wielded one of the infernal devices and didn't let the damn sword corrupt him. He put his life on the line for his homeland again and again. He deserved better than to die at the hand of some sneaking assassin over some stupid piece of politics.
I remember, Harold.
Fisher looked down at the dusty marble face.
But it's hard to say who I remember. I was intimate with him for a time, you know that. But I can't say I ever really knew him. He had so many faces to show different people at different times. Whether the face he showed me was the real him, I couldn't say. He never let anyone get close to him. But he was always kind to me and did his best to protect me. He tried to understand me when no one else did. And yet whether he really cared for me or just wanted me, I never knew. Now he's gone, and I'll never know.
I never liked him, but I always thought he'd make a good king. Far better than me. He always knew the right thing to say. How to get people to do what he wanted, while still thinking it was their own idea. And he had a real gift for organization. Loved paperwork. Harold was the politician in the family. He should have been the perfect king for the transition between the old ways and the new. It was only because I believed that I was able to leave the forest with you. I could have been king if I'd chosen. There were many who would have backed my claim to the throne, but that would have meant civil war, and I didn't want that. I didn't want to be king. Harold was the much better bet. But did I believe that because I wanted to? Because I didn't want all the duties and responsibilities that went with being king?
You did what you thought was best. That's all any of us can ever do.
She let her fingertips drift slowly across the cold marble of Harold's face, leaving creamy white trails in the dust. Fisher snatched her hand back as a shower of brilliant sparks erupted from the carved face. Hawk and Fisher backed away, hands dropping to their weapons, and watched in amazement as the sparks circled and spun before rushing together to form a perfect image of the late King Harold.